Blog Talk Radio.
Apparently, I'm on the air. This is Forbidden America. And once again, I'm Steve, your host. Back again. This is the second episode of the reformulated Forbidden America. For those of you that knew it from before, we've been airing this show since the end of 2010, beginning of 2011. And then took a hiatus. But I decided to put it back on the air because there's a lot to talk about. If you know anything about what's going on in current events, you know what I mean. Yesterday, or a couple of days ago, when I did this first return show, I talked about issues that had to do with the power paradigm in this country right now. In the United States, and what it really means and what it really is and how it got there and why people are coming up to the southern side of the border and how it was our doing that created that situation. Today, I'm going to do a little something different, but it's kind of an extension of what I talked about a couple of days ago. And tonight's episode is racism. Is it racism or is it a class war? And what does class war mean? I'm going to show you what the historical evidence for racism is in the United States, or what was to become the United States. There are two examples that jump right out in history that are very plain to see and that are... you're going to think, oh, we're going to talk about history, so it's boring, but it isn't. These are two different incidents in the history of this country that show you why racism exists as you know it today, and it's going to surprise you, okay? The first one, the first one happened in the year 1676. That's right, folks. White people have been fucking this place up for a long time. And I'm a white guy, so, you know, I think it's safe to say that that's a fact. But in 1676, in Virginia, you know, there were no states. They were barely, there were barely formed colonies. There were people here that paid taxes to the crown of England, but one of them was Virginia, and it was one of the first ones, and it became a real stronghold for white folks that had come to settle here from wherever. And so in the beginning times, there were mostly, on the east coast of the United States, there were mostly white folks that were from Europe and chiefly England. And so in Virginia, there was a governor that had been appointed by the Crown of England, which all governors were appointed by the Crown of England in those days. And his name was William Berkeley. Back in those days, if you were a governor, you had total control. You were the shit. You were the dude. And so Berkeley, answering to the Crown, is running business, right? His job is to exploit the natural resources of the area and to trade with the indigenous population and to take these resources, get them on a ship, and send them back to England so that they can do what they want to do with it. So his job is to further the glory of the English Empire. Okay, so one of the people in his area of Virginia, Jamestown and those, you know, that general area, was named Nathaniel Bacon. Okay, so what ends up happening is that various groups kind of start talking amongst each other over beers or whatever, and they start deciding amongst each other that they don't like the way things are being run. Okay. And in those days, there were slaves there, but they were indentured servants and or slaves of various colors, okay? So it wasn't just black slaves, and it wasn't black slaves and white indentured servants. It was a mix. That's the point of the show tonight, is that there was a time when it didn't look the way it does now, and we're going to get to why this happened. Berkeley, the governor, he has really good relations with the Native Americans in the Virginia area. And Berkeley doesn't want to upset the balance of power that he has with the Native Americans. Okay, so Bacon, in the meantime, is a politician, and you know, he's a power broker, and they had what they call the House of Burgesses, which was like almost like a parliament, and they enacted what is known as Bacon's Laws, and Bacon was really trying to stir the pot and tip the balance of power. Bacon didn't think he was getting enough of a piece of the pie. Okay, so they used to get into squabbles in public. And basically it amounted to a pissing contest. And Berkeley at one point even opened up his clothing and bared his chest and said to Bacon, you know, in front of a big crowd, shoot me. Basically grandstanding. And so Bacon does not like Berkeley. And part of the reason he doesn't like him is the way in which he's dealing with the local economy and the way in which he's allied with Britain. And so there were four things that he didn't like. And so Bacon and what became Bacon's army, literally an army of about 600 or 700 men, issued the Declaration of the People of Virginia. They decided to call this document. And it criticized Governor Berkeley on 4 points. And I'm getting to why this created racism in the United States, what became the United States. The 4 points were that taxes were unfair, oldest argument in the book. Two was he put his cronies and his buddies in positions of power. Again, one of the oldest things you'll find in politics. Three, he monopolized the trading with the Native Americans, and that he was basically too pro-Native American, that he didn't subjugate them or mistreat them enough. He treated them too well. So these were the arguments against Governor Berkeley. And so there was an insurrection, right? So Bacon takes his, you know, they're a bunch of drunks, and Bacon takes his guys and he goes marauding through the countryside to overthrow Berkeley. Causes a lot of mischief and mayhem. People die. Quite a few people die. But here's the thing. During this process, some of the people that took part in Bacon's army were indentured servants and slaves of both races, right? The white race and the black race. And I'm going to make it simple and just say black and white just for the sake of time. Well, finding this out, the power elite, right, which are basically these are the people that would later become the landholders, that would be the the electorate, okay? Back then, you had to be a white man with land, because only people with land paid those kinds of taxes that would deal with, like, infrastructure and, you know, the heavy taxes. Therefore, they were the only people that could vote. They were the Electoral College, essentially. And they decided who was going to be in office and who wasn't. They ran everything. Rich white men. Kind of like now. Not different. Okay. So they decided they didn't like the fact that all of these people all kind of got woke, you know, like to coin today's phrase, and all attacked them in unison it frightened the shit out of them, all right? And so not wanting to go through that again, they came up with a strategy. So the basically, you know, the 1% of their day, right? Like we have a 1% today. Well, they had a 1%. Berkeley, his cronies, all the rich white landowners, they said, we're going to create, drive a wedge between them and create division. They started a psychological campaign of misinformation and propaganda, made people start believing that there were problems between the black slaves and the white slaves. The white slaves are now being told that there was no reason why they should be held in such low esteem as these black guys. And that the black guys are trying to do this, and the black guys are trying to do that, and the black guys were now a threat. And the people that weren't slaves started buying into this as well. So now you have a manufactured attitude regarding black versus white versus black, polarizing the two sides and making it, driving the level of animosity so deep that it was irrevocable. Okay. So now we have racism, right? That can't be undone, so that you didn't have a unified front to focus on the real problem, which was the rich white cocksuckers that were holding everybody hostage and everybody in some sort of servitude. And so eventually Bacon gets defeated. Berkeley does kind of get driven off of his seat, and he has to get on a boat and is recalled to England, but not until putting down the insurrection. And so Bacon's rebellion is not successful, but the lasting legacy of the rebellion is that we now have a prevailing attitude that never, you know, like once you see something, you can't unsee it. Once you hear something, you can't unhear it. We never shed the earworm that we had received as a society that, you know, oh, it's well, those black guys. Well, we got to watch them. And not only was it white free people thinking that way now about the dangerous black people who could rise up at any moment, but also the white slaves, the white indentured servants were also thinking the same way because it was done on the basis of race. It was a psychological operation by the 1%. And this is where it started in this country. Racism isn't new. Racism's been everywhere, just like slavery's been everywhere. But the white versus black thing started, right, in the late 1600s because of Bacon's Rebellion. Now, let's go forward in time. There's one more little tidbit that deserves to be talked about with regard to this. The year 1791. I think I'll have a drink of my iced tea because I'm dry. And yes, it's really iced tea. In 1791, in what is now Haiti, you had a man who was mulatto, right? He was the son of a black lady who was begotten by a white landowner. Therefore, he's mulatto. And he grows up, his name is Julien Raymond. So Julien Raymond, which we can, you know, Anglicanize it, he became a slave owner himself. He became influential and politically powerful because of his dad. And here's the interesting thing about him. And it really is kind of, it's hard to believe. But here he is, a black man. But he does the same thing that the 1% did during Bacon's Rebellion. He wants everybody to think, he wants everyone to believe that the darker you are, the more deserving you are of being enslaved. He wants people of color to wholeheartedly believe that because they are of color, it is natural for them to be enslaved. It is the way of things. He really wants people of color to believe that and be okay with that. Okay. And, you know, I have a listener that's out there in the field right now who's messaging on the background. and reminds me that, you know, the United States, as we know it today, what became the United States and still is here, was the first country to be incepted and created from the ground up, based on and organized by a capitalist business plan. Capitalism from the get-go. All right, so the laws here are different from the UK. The UK, you know, England and the UK, they didn't have slavery. It was illegal. And the common law, right, didn't exist here like it did in the UK. So he wants to make the point that the listener does that how does this fit into the capitalist paradigm? It very much does. Capitalism has a love affair with slavery. If you don't think there are currently slaves in the business model of the United States, you better start thinking again, because there are. And there's different ways in which this happens. But so this Raymond in Haiti, he wanted everybody to think that if you are of color, you deserve and are rightly supposed to be enslaved, okay? He wanted racial prejudice to exist, and he wanted it to flourish as a means of control. And this was from somebody of color, but he wasn't dark enough to be worthy of racism. He was light enough to escape it, and he wanted the racial prejudice to exist. So once again, you know, this is ugly stuff. This is ugly. But this is why in the United States, I say the United States, I don't say America. Everyone says, you know, in America. Well, it really isn't. Because America is the whole Western hemisphere of the planet, right? You get North America, Central America, South America. And so to say that this is America is kind of, you know, it's dismissive of all the other areas of this hemisphere. It's all America. This just happens to be the United States of America, because we're in America, but we're the United States of America. And America goes from the pole to the end of Argentina. So that's just a side note I wanted to bring up. So racism, really, in terms of how you see it today, how it manifests, what we're used to seeing, it was manufactured. It was consciously, right? It was consciously created in a way and in a form that would perpetuate, we're unique in that regard. Does racism exist anyway? Yes. Does it exist, you know, around the planet? Yes. But mostly later in history. Certainly after all of these things that I'm telling you, it really started to proliferate. Prior to then, not so much. Slavery was slavery. When factions of Arabic peoples started paying mercenaries and paying local tribes in Western Africa to go get other people to bring to the shoreline to be sold into slavery onto these ships and shipped to the New World, they didn't care that they were black. They just cared that they were alive and could be enslaved. They didn't do it because they were black. They did it because they were plentiful. The Arabic peoples have a very long history of slavery. The Egyptians did, you know, the Sumerians did. You can go to any society in any culture, and go as far back in history as you would like to go, and you will find slaves. In Pompeii, right? When they dug up Pompeii and they said, oh, look, we found out what happened. We're able to, you know, finally recount that day, what happened on that day when this all went to hell. And they were able to find who the slaves were. They had slaves. And they were able to determine that none of those slaves were of color. They just weren't. In India, right, you have a caste system of three castes. And in the lower caste, they're treated essentially as slaves. That's how they're treated. But they're all Indian. They all look basically the same. They're just born into three different castes. So the racial thing is artificial, and the racial thing is kind of a new wrinkle in all of this in the history of humanity. And it really, really took hold here in the United States. And it was done, two examples that I gave you, you know, in the late 1600s, a long time ago. And then again, you know, in the late 1700s. And, you know, when the Spaniards landed on the other side in Central America and the lower part of North America, like in Mexico, they enslaved all these people, which could not be described as black people, but certainly racially they were different than the Spaniards that were landing there. And, you know, you had, when we invaded, when I say we, I mean Western Europeans, when we invaded North America and we started pushing around the Native Americans and killing them by the millions, literally, pushing them out of the way, we enslaved a lot of them. So slavery is not new. But racial prejudice, racism, that was manufactured as a tool to keep the 1% in power. So, and that's a point that one of my listeners is making right now, that, you know, white men protect the actual people with the power, like the 1%, or the capitalists with a capital C. And each side is entrenched, so the struggles continue. The struggles will continue because that's the design of the paradigm. Without the struggle, everybody starts focusing on the real problem, which is those greedy cocksuckers in the high rises. They're the problem. You know, are the people coming over the border in the United States trying to make some money, trying to get to where there's air conditioning, trying to be where they're not being shot at, trying to get where there's medicine for their children? You know, are those people the problem? No, they're just trying to survive. That's not a problem for us. It's a problem for them. But if they're being hired, who are they being hired by? Well, there's your problem. Because if no one hires them, then there's no reason for them to come here. Okay? So the lower you keep people down, the more you keep your boot on their neck, right? Eventually, and I said in the last show a couple days ago that capitalism has a shelf life. It has a shelf life. It can't go on forever. And when it starts to die, it starts to turn to fascism. Because people start to wake up and go, wait a minute, this isn't working. How long can this go on? And then because they're getting more and more aware of it, they get more and more heavy-handed about keeping you in line. More and more people living in tents. More and more people, you know, just being squeezed out and pushed aside. And the more of that that happens, the more people are, you can't escape it. It's inescapable. You can't not see it anymore. And that's when fascism takes over, to enforce the will of the same 1% who want to stay in power. So what is racism? Is it a class war? Yes. Racism was invented in order for the class war to be won by the upper class. And why do they call it upper class? Because class, you know, when people say, oh, so-and-so is classy, they tend to mean, you know, like, somebody to admire, somebody that's beautiful, somebody that has money, somebody that, you know, acts really well and confident, and somebody I want to be. But really, it doesn't mean that. It means wealthy, right? The upper class is wealthy. And what do I mean by wealthy? If someone's rich, the person writing their checks is wealthy. That's what I mean. Wealthy. Like, fuck you money, right? And those people are the upper class. Why? Because they have money. And then there's the middle class, which is the people making $50,000 a year or whatever. And I'll tell you right now, folks, in case you don't already know it, you probably do, but you might not, $50,000 a year right now is the moon to most people. They're not going to see that again. And they're pissed about it because they can't move ahead because there's no way to do it. Because the jobs, you know, by jobs, I mean the jobs that you can earn money at $50,000 a year are really hard to find. And those were sold out to companies where they don't have to pay people that anymore. They don't. If they can get somebody to do it for half of that, they will. And they do. Just look around. What used to pay decently doesn't pay decently anymore. This all comes down to money and power. Just like the last show, right? Comes down to money and power. Racism was invented so that you would find a scapegoat and they would keep ringing that siren so that you see the emergency of, oh my God, black people. Oh my God, black people. And you fall for it every friggin' time. I don't mean you personally, but as a society. Fall for it every time. And it's getting old. You know, what do they want, black people? Well, what do you want? Well, that's what they want. They're just people. And it's so ingrained. It's been going on for so long, and they are so successful at running this psychological operation, which is what it is. They're so good at it that you can't remember a time when it didn't exist. You can't remember a time when there wasn't a struggle, and we're so busy dealing with it that we don't deal with them. And now it's come down to the wire again. I think it's like a cycle. The more people that realize, wait a minute, these folks aren't the problem. They're just my neighbors. And if we start figuring that out and say, well, what if we work together and vote people in that we know are going to do what's right? And if they decide to invalidate our votes or manipulate the elections, what do we do together to keep them from succeeding at that? You know, how do you not have Bernie Sanders have a landslide victory in New Hampshire and then somebody take it away from them at the last moment because they bought out the Electoral College? In other countries, when shit like that happens, blood is spilled. In this country, we're so used to being shit on that, you know, we think we're getting a peanut butter sandwich. And nobody knows the difference between shit and peanut butter anymore. So I sound a little fatalistic. I sound a little depressed about it. I'm not. I'm simply pointing out what it is. Capitalism has a shelf life. It doesn't work. Works great for a few people for a while. And then it's like any pyramid scheme. It's going to collapse in and on itself. It's doing that now. And it is not a business model or a paradigm based on compassion. And because we lose sight of that, because we don't go about it as human beings that care about each other, it's bound to fail anyway. You know, Neoplatonic thought is everybody's connected to the divine, nobody's connected to each other, right? But tribal thought is everyone's connected to each other, and we are the divine. So I subscribe to the latter. But people that buy into capitalism, you can't subscribe to that because it doesn't fit into the business model. You have to subscribe to Neoplatonic thought where you have the sovereign responsibility and right to lay waste to whatever you need to lay waste to in order to get where you're going fiscally. And look what it's done to the environment. Look what it's done to race relations. Look what it's done to everything. So yes, is it racism? Yes, but why? Because of the class war. The 1% invented it. It's keeping everybody at each other's throats to keep everybody's focus off of them. So that's the end of the show, folks. Goes by quick. I will be back again in another day or two with another show. I'm thinking about maybe doing one on labor. But we'll see you next time, and I thank you very much for coming in and listening. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.